You're listening to the Liberty News Radio Network, and this is the Political Cesspool.
We are a band of brothers and native to the soil, fighting for the property we gained by honest toil. And when our rights were threatened, the cry rose near and far. First gallant South Carolina nobly made the stand. Then came Alabama and took her by the hand. Next quickly Mississippi, Georgia and Florida, all raised on high the bonny blue flag that bears a single star.
Hurrah!
Hurrah! Hurrah! For Southern rights, hurrah! Hurrah for the bonny blue flag that bears a single star.
And welcome back, everyone, to the Political Cesspool Radio program, where our celebration of Confederate History Month continues here each and every April. And, of course, because of our genuine pride of Southern history and heritage, and our deep love and respect for our ancestors who fought to preserve the American way of life from 1861 to 1865, we present this annual showcase. Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Memphian, a Tennessean born, lived in Memphis for most of his life, died here, of course, buried in Memphis, as we all know. You know, you can't pick a favorite Confederate hero, but he has to be right up there at the top, you know, certainly for me. I read this every year. I want to read it quickly and then toss it over to Keith because Nathan Bedford Forrest is back in the news this week. Facts about Nathan Bedford Forrest. We've gone over these before, but let's do it again. He became a self-made millionaire despite being born into poverty and having no formal education. He invested a great deal of that personal fortune, the majority of it, to aid the Confederate cause, and despite being one of the wealthiest men in the South, he enlisted as a soldier of the lowest rank. Even though he was exempt from having to serve, he still went in as a buck private to further serve his country. He chose to serve. He had no formal military training, but went on to become one of the greatest tacticians in the history of mobile warfare. He retired as a lieutenant general. His maneuvers are still studied today by armies. He personally killed over 30 enemy combatants. He was a man's man. And this certainly ties into what we were talking about in the first hour, Keith, with modern day people in business and political heavyweights. You know, compare the character and heroism embodied by a guy like General Forrest to the people we were talking about in the first hour. This guy makes me proud to be a Memphian, proud to be a Southerner, proud to be a Confederate, an ancestor of a Confederate veteran. Why was he back in the news, though, again this week, Keith? Obviously for nothing good.
Well, today, April the 12th, 2014, is the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Fort Pillow in Tennessee, just north of Memphis, which supposedly was a massacre of black troops by the forces led by Nathan Bedford Forrest. Now, there was an article in today's Commercial Appeal, known affectionately to locals here as the Communist Appeal, and a writer named David Walter said that previously about Nathan Bedford Forrest. Now, that's his first lie, because he is a card-carrying liberal, and I can guarantee you that he never entertained any kind thoughts about Nathan Bedford Forrest at any time in his life. And if he had, he wouldn't have been hired to write articles for the Commercial Appeal. But nonetheless, he said he has seen this new movie made by a history professor at one of our local colleges, Rhodes College, in Memphis, Tennessee, named D. Garcineau, about Fort Pillow. And, of course, it is totally slanted to the viewpoint of the left, which has basically their story of atrocities is corroborated by one Confederate soldier, a guy named Achille Clark. And I think if you're going to impugn a man with as great a reputation as General Forrest, you need more than one attribution for his viewpoint. Now, there were black soldiers in the Union that said that there was an atrocity going on, but of course, that is to be expected. They lost, and they lost shamefully. They were absolutely beaten like a barred mule in that battle. So it's a lot better to try to turn this into some type of massacre when actually it was a rout in which black soldiers, in their headlong desire to escape, after refusing to surrender, slid down a hill, and a lot of them drowned in the Mississippi River because then, like now, a lot of them didn't know how to swim. But the fact of the matter is, see, this is a hit piece. Hit pieces against the Confederacy and against the people who would rever Confederate historical figures like Nathan Bedford Forrest and Robert E. Lee are now commonplace in the media. We had the American Experience documentary on Robert E. Lee a couple of years ago, which tried to impugn the memory of Robert E. Lee, who was probably one of the noblest men ever to fight in a war anywhere. He was, as Theodore Roosevelt called him, the greatest of all the great captains that the English-speaking people have ever produced. That's pretty high praise. He was the only person who has ever gone through West Point without earning a single demerit. But he was named in this PBS documentary as the bloodiest general who despaired and said that his biggest mistake of his life was taking military training. And to put the cherry on top, they said that he encouraged the whipping of black slave women. There's one attribution for that accusation too, just like there's one attribution from a Confederate confirming that there was a massacre at Fort Pillow. But again, if you're going to impugn a historical figure as important as Robert E. Lee, you need more than one attribution if you are a standard historian writing history in the way the history has always been written. But of course, the left bends the rules when it's necessary to turn history into a teaching parable for one of the left's favorite ideas, which is that blacks were terribly mistreated in the antebellum South, one, and two, that the Civil War was fought exclusively about the issue of slavery. Now, even black editorialists in the local newspaper, the Tri-State Defender, the local black weekly newspaper, have gotten wise to this business. They've written an article about April's significance and the truth about Lincoln, written by Robin Brown. And she basically has come to the same conclusion that we did, that the historical record is replete with all sorts of evidence that Abraham Lincoln was anything but the great emancipator. He was just a big maven of big government and the first person that was ruthlessly willing to quell any type of effort to split the country in two because he wanted America to be a big, prosperous, large nation that could project power and influence on a global scale. That's the real reason that Lincoln fought the Civil War, not to free the slaves. Freeing the slaves was just an incident that's happened for a variety of historical accidents. But getting back to General Nathan Bedford Forrest, Forrest was actually exonerated in a court-martial held by his greatest enemy in the war, William Tecumseh Sherman. We'll tell you the details of all that after these words from our sponsor.
Are you familiar with the term vigor? Strength in body and mind? He pursued his tennis game with vigor, for example? Well, I hadn't, but I learned about it from Kirk Crosby. All right, and he actually let me take a scientifically proven free vigor test. And I got 13 out of 32, not very good. But I worked on it with him, and believe it or not, now I have a 29 out of 32 and improving vigor score. You say, Sam, what on earth is this scientific vigor score, huh? My response is you got to take the free test, available now. Get a hold of Kirk Crosby to learn about it. The number is 801-669-2211. That's 801-669-2211. Or email Kurt, C-U-R-T, at libertyroundtable.com. That's Kurt, C-U-R-T, at libertyroundtable.com for your free vigor test today. Kurt, libertyroundtable.com, or 801-669-2211. Vigor test free. free, scientifically proven today.
We fought, we learned, we struggled, we won. Despite Obama's best efforts, the newspaper of the human resistance survives. We have lived only to face a new nightmare, the war against the machines. Read about our struggle in The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. The Sovereign is a 24-page monthly tabloid newspaper about the war between man and machines. We've tried reason, we've tried legislation. We've tried every peaceful means imaginable, and all it's gotten us is shut out. So now we fight the machines. Order online today at thesovnews.com or find The Sovereign at select newsstands. Remember to read The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. The human resistance's battle against the machines will be everlasting. This is mercy. It was never our destiny to stop the age of Obama. It was merely to survive it. Together. Together.
Imagine a school where faith and integrity are at its center, where heritage and responsibility instill character, where educating both hearts and minds brings about academic excellence. There is a school in American Fork where character and embracing the providence of a living God are fundamental, where students' national test scores average near the 90th percentile. Based on LDS principles and a love of country, now in our 39th year, American Heritage School is accepting fall enrollment for kindergarten through high school. What would you do for your child? Give them an education that will prepare them for life. Located east of the Temple in American Fork, American Heritage School is a remarkable and affordable alternative. Visit us, find us online, or in the Yellow Pages. American Heritage School in American Fork.
To get on the show and speak with James and the gang, call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. And now, back to tonight's show.
When Robert E. Lee surrendered to Confederacy, Jefferson Davis was upset about it. He said, "How dare that man rescind an order from the President of the Confederate States of America?" And then somebody told him that General Lee had made the decision himself in order to save lives, because he felt that the battle coming up would cost about 20,000 lives on both sides. And he said, 240,000 dead already is enough. So this song is not about the North or the South, but about the bloody brother war. Brother against brother, father against son, the war that nobody won. And for all those lives that were saved, I gotta say, God bless Robert E. Lee. Well, the mansion where the general used to live is burning down. Cotton fields are blue with Sherman's troops. I overheard a Yankee say, "Yesterday Nashville fell." So I'm on my way to join the fight. General Lee might need my help. But look away, Dixie. I don't want them to see what they're doing to my Dixie. God bless Robert E. Lee.
I'll let that song play just a little bit longer than we normally like to, because, you know, that wasn't very long ago, folks. 50, 60 years, you had some of the biggest superstars in entertainment, people like Robert E. Lee, Johnny Cash, praising, rightfully so, Robert E. Lee. Johnny Cash, I mean, compare that is a radical transformation in very short order. And if we have to extend our guest who has joined us now into the last segment of this hour, we'll do so, so to make sure she has plenty of time. But I wanted to play that. That was, you know, Johnny Cash, God Bless Robert E. Lee. That was a song, by the way, that was sent in from a political cesspool fan, Lisa in Lubbock, Texas, helping us with the musical selections tonight for Confederate History Month. And we're so happy to have Lisa and everyone else enjoying our presentation. And before we get to our guest this hour, Keith, I want you to quickly wrap up what you were talking about a moment ago in the first segment. And that was, of course, the fact that Nathan Bedford Forrest is again being retried for supposed crimes, war crimes, that were alleged to have been committed at Fort Pillow. Of course, as you mentioned, he was exonerated, found not guilty of all charges by his biggest adversaries. And it's amazing to me that you had people like William Tecumseh Sherman, who was truly a war criminal, who was truly a terrorist, who was truly a maniac. But you had people like that who wanted nothing more than to see Forrest hanged, and even he found no fault in the man. But I'm glad today that we have reporters that are so smart that 150 years later, they can ferret out the facts of the case that Nathan Bedford Forrest's biggest detractors at the time couldn't.
Well, it goes to show that the primary casualty of political correctness is the truth. No one was more hostile towards Nathan Bedford Forrest than William Tecumseh Sherman. He said that if it cost 100,000 troops and bankrupted the federal treasury, they needed to capture and hang Nathan Bedford Forrest. Well, he was in charge of the court-martial of Nathan Bedford Forrest regarding Fort Pillow that was held after the hostilities ended in the Civil War. He looked at all the evidence, and he had to conclude that Forrest had done nothing wrong, had not violated any of the rules of war, and consequently, he exonerated Nathan Bedford Forrest. Now, the true war criminal was William Tecumseh Sherman, and William Tecumseh Sherman, if all these black supporters of William Tecumseh Sherman and detractors of Nathan Bedford Forrest, if they want to see a real war crime, they ought to study for a while what happened to the black women of Savannah, Georgia, when Uncle Billy's troops made it in their Sherman's March of the Sea to Savannah, Georgia.
And of course, in the meantime, you mentioned the truth is the greatest victim of political correctness. Nathan Bedford Forrest's grave is desecrated here. It's spit upon. It's graffitied. It's mocked and derided, whereas William Tecumseh Sherman
is lionized.
He has a gilded, which means, of course, folks, gold-plated statue in Central Park in New York. It's one of the most tacky things, very much befitting of a guy like him. But, of course, he is seen as a hero. All right. It's live radio, so it doesn't always go according to plan. And as I said, if we have to extend Courtney from Alabama into the fourth segment of this hour to make sure she has all the time she needs to work through her presentation, then that's exactly what we'll do. We're glad to have her back. Courtney, are you with us?
I am.
Well, thanks for being there. People may remember Courtney was actually in the studio with us last fall sometime to talk about cooking and Southern cuisine, and it was a great interview, and we expect tonight will be equally good. So, Courtney, why don't you set the table here, getting started late this segment again, but tell us some of the things you want to talk about tonight.
Okay. Well, first of all, you all were talking about Robert E. Lee a minute ago, and I just want to talk about what a great man my father is to have raised me to be proud of my Southern heritage. He never said anything negative about Robert E. Lee. It was always positive things. He always salutes Robert E. Lee whenever he drives by one of his statues. And so that's why I am the way I am. and also I want to thank, I thought Wilburn Gregory did a really good job when he was on the show recently, and then of course Kevin MacDonald, and it's just a fascinating topic. And unfortunately, even though I was raised on this stuff, I mean, if I had my father here with me, he could talk all about the Civil War all day long. But since I'm female, and even though I'm so proud of that history, I don't know as much about it. I'm more interested in how our culture has manifested itself, and I'm just so proud of, you know, what makes the South unique, and it has so many good qualities that represent the way that what the rest of America should be. And before I go into all this, I don't want to say anything that I'm not trying to offend or be divisive towards anybody north of the Mason-Dixon line. I want most of my criticisms are going to be of people who are specifically blue state liberals. You know, that's
right.
What I'm trying to focus
well,
on.
And we certainly made mention of the fact last week that Confederate History Month is something that should be celebrated by all people, because what they stood for is truly something that was the best that America had to offer in terms of the caliber of the men that were there and their right thinking on the issues of sovereignty and states' rights and things of that nature. But yeah, you were going to talk, I believe, Courtney, about traditional roles in the South to begin with?
Yes, that's my first topic. And it's mainly what I noticed in the state of Alabama. And I'm just so thankful that Alabama has not been corrupted with the blue state invasion as much as other southern states have, like Florida, for instance. And so I'm going to talk about traditional gender roles. It's a good segue in between the topics of the previous shows and what we're talking about now, because I have really been noticing just how, you know, you were just talking about Hank Aaron a minute ago and how, you know, things are still like they were in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and that's a bad thing. Well, I'm glad to see that a lot of things haven't changed in the South, and gender roles are one of them. At least that's how I see it in Alabama. So anyways, to begin with, Jared Taylor wrote an article in the early 90s going into the gender roles that he noticed when he was over in Japan and how they were still very separate over there and traditional. And there was a phrase he used. He said that men and women over there operate in separate spheres. And I'd have to say, like, based on my observations as an Alabamian, I'd have to say that that's how it is in Alabama, too, probably in most of the Deep South and other areas that haven't been influenced. And basically what you see down here is you see there's male jobs that are occupied by men. There's female jobs that women should have that are occupied by women. And then when you see a mixture of the two in an establishment, usually it consists of a few men being in charge of everything. And then there's a bunch of women who are working in supportive roles of assistants, receptionists, jobs where they greet people, interact with people. And we can all agree that probably Southern women are the best at greeting and interacting with people, being receptionists. And
certainly.
So anyways, like, just to go through a bunch of examples, you see it in government buildings, the courthouses. I just really don't see very many female lawyers or judges in Alabama. Usually if you go into a courthouse, most of the women are occupying all the assistant roles. I mean, Keith would know all the names of all these different roles. I don't. But, like, the woman that sits in the room and she types everything, and, you know, that those are all occupied by women.
Court reporter.
I hardly ever, you know, hear of any female judges in this state, or I don't know of them, or lawyers. I don't see any billboards about them. Doctor's offices, it's the same thing. Like, you go into a dentist's office, and the dentist is usually a male, well, always male, pretty much, and then all the supportive roles in the office, the women taking care of the files up front, the women that check you in, the assistants, those are all occupied by women. And it's kind of the dentist is the one that kind of runs the show. You see the same thing in churches down here. Men kind of run things in the church. The only departments where women are in charge are usually the ones dealing with children. And I have to, you know, we talk about the Baptist Church a lot and how it's been corrupted, but I have to, you know, I say this on the website a lot. I mean, I have to hand it to the Baptist Church for still standing firm on gender roles and sexuality. And at least that's how I see it, all the churches I've been to. Other types of businesses, even in beauty salons, usually there's a man that's in charge that runs the shop, and then, you know, all the women do the hair and everything. And then usually, like, if there is any business that's run by a woman, it's something like a bakery or a shop that sells baby clothes or something like that. And then you have, Keith mentioned this when he had Roger Devlin on, you have a lot of the traditional businesses where there's a man in charge and then his wife operates with him and she's kind of the assistant or the receptionist. See that in car repair shops a lot. Like, if there is a woman working there, she's always a receptionist, and she's usually related to the top car mechanic or the guy that owns the place. And, you know, and they stay in the business together for life, as it should be. And then the only time I really...
Hey, Courtney, Courtney, if I could interrupt you right there just for a moment. We're going to take a commercial break, and we're going to continue with this, folks, right after these words.
No matter which way you choose, the political cesspool needs your support. Go online to www.thepoliticalcesspool.org and make a donation today. It's time to jump back into the political cesspool. To be part of the show and have your voice heard around the world, call us at 1-866-986-6397.
All right, are we up, Ben? Okay, everybody, welcome back to the political cesspool there. A little convoluted commercial break. He's coming in on my headset, but we're with Courtney from Alabama, who is our guest here as we celebrate Confederate history. And as she mentioned, we're not so much talking about the actual history of the Confederate States of America as it existed in 1861 to 1865 in this particular segment, but we are talking about the culture that gave birth to it. And there is still a distinct Southern culture that exists that is, in fact, a prerequisite for nationhood and independence. You know, certainly one of the great cases that has to be made when a region wants to have autonomy is to have a culture that is separate and unique from its surrounding areas. And as watered down as it is in the year 2014, that still exists here in the South, not nearly to the extent that it did in the 19th century or even 50 or 60 years ago. But Courtney's drawing a few from a few examples that she's identified, and I certainly agree with them. So Courtney, that being said, continue, and we'll let Keith weigh in on this as well.
Okay, sure. Thank you. So, yeah, what I was saying going into the commercial break, and again, this is based on my observation, it seems whenever you do see an establishment or a business down here where women are kind of in charge or they're making their way to the top and they have these overbearing roles, usually those are companies and institutions where you have, you're drawing in a lot of people from outside the state and outside the South. Like, you're drawing in a lot of transplants. I seriously just can't think of any business in the state of Alabama where you have women running things, unless it's something like a bakery or something feminine related, where the people working there are native Southerners. I just really don't see that. Like, a good example would be a scientific research institute or something. Usually that attracts a lot of people from other parts of the country, and that's where you see women moving to the top and everything. And another thing, like, okay, talking about jobs that are traditionally male-dominated, like firemen, state troopers, as I've mentioned on the website before, I temporarily, in my early 20s, I'm not going to say which state it was, but in my early 20s, I lived in a blue state temporarily, and the cultural difference was just phenomenal. And to give an example, like observing the firemen up there versus the firemen down here, up there, I would see people of all shapes and sizes, women, men, on a fireman unit or whatever you call it. down here, whenever I see firemen, they all look like the type of person you would want to rescue you if you're stuck in a burning building. They're all able-bodied men, strong, fit. And, the same thing with state troopers going down the interstate. I mean, they all look the same. They're all tall, broad shoulders. They're all male, clean-cut looking, attractive, the type of person that you would want to be a state trooper. And, again, like, up in the blue state I live in, you didn't see that. You were more likely to see female cops all the time. I hardly ever see that down here. And if I do, it's the female cop is usually black.
Just a moment. Courtney, this is Keith. I do remember that incident in Atlanta where the black criminal defendant in court overpowered some white bailiff. Or excuse me, not white, but I mean female bailiff. I don't know if she was white or black, but nonetheless, at least in some of the big urban areas, particularly those with a large minority population like Memphis or Atlanta, you do see some of these gender role reversals that thankfully a lot of the South has escaped. But I would say that a lot of the reason things haven't changed is that both men and women don't want them to change in the South. Men and women are very comfortable with their traditional roles in society. Men are men and women are women, and men and women in the South are glad of it. Do you think that's true?
Actually, you touched on something I forgot to mention earlier. Thank you. The important factor here that I forgot to mention is that everybody seems to be happy with the roles they're in. Whenever I go into these establishments, the men like being in charge, and the women just, you know, strut around smiling, in their supportive roles, their supportive secondary roles. They're happy doing it. There's no complaining. There's no bitterness or friction. And like as you're saying, it's because it's natural. And, another example of going to the AR conference at that location in Tennessee, you see the same thing. Like any woman who works there as a waitress or she works at the front desk, she's usually attractive, well-dressed, whereas, you know, if you look at the men who were protecting us from the protesters, they were all male. You know, all the policemen are protecting us there. They all look like these state troopers I see in Alabama. They look the way they should. So roles down here are just very, they're still very old-fashioned. They're natural, as they should be. And it's just such a contrast from what I saw living in a blue state. And why I think this is so important is, I noticed that Southern men still have a natural instinct to want to take care of, protect, and help women. And, like, I could be at a gas station, and I need help changing a tire or simply just putting air in a tire, and I can go inside and easily get help from somebody. It happens all the time down here. It's normal. When a man sees the woman who needs help, he helps her. And likewise, it's a two-way street. It goes both ways. The women are gracious, as they should be. And that's what you have to have in an environment like that. When you have a culture in a lot of these blue states where feminism and liberalism have taken over, nobody wants to help anybody. Nobody trusts anybody. And it concerns me. I really want the South to stay the way it is, because when things start getting bad, I feel more comfortable when the men are in control, when the men are willing to help me, than, where it's every man for himself.
Every person for themselves. Courtney, I think there's a lot of wisdom in what you say. I don't think that men or women in the South are willing to surrender their traditional sexual roles. I don't think you could breed out of a Southern man the instinct to open a door for a woman, for example.
Exactly, and I love that. The men are happy to do it, and the women are accepting of it and thankful and gracious for it. It has to be a two-way thing. If I were in a building and there was a fire and everybody had to escape, I'd prefer to be around a bunch of Southerners where the men are taking charge, leading the women down the stairs, letting them go first, and the women are accommodating. They're saying thank you, they're gracious, and they're working with the men.
It reminds me of the way the world used to be. We've all seen these movies about the Titanic where white millionaire men were deferring to immigrant women, letting them get on the lifeboats while they were going to certain death because of this chivalrous attitude. All society benefits from that, women in particular, children in particular. I can't help but note about this when you're talking about how men and women in small businesses, husbands and wives, work together. Mm-hmm. The one common denominator I have found is that the woman is always stationed close to the cash register. Have you noticed that?
Yes.
Rimshot.
Southern women really are good when it comes to greeting somebody, smiling, and just making them feel good when they enter an establishment. But yes, the men are good at controlling everything behind the scenes. Another interesting anecdote is, when I lived in a blue state and would come home to visit family for Christmas, I would get on a connecting flight in between, and on the flight from the blue state to the state that was in between Alabama and the blue state, usually, you know, everybody just sat in their seats. It was quiet. You know, you kept your eyes straight forward. You know, it was just a very unsociable and hospitable environment on the airplane. But then once I got on the connecting flight, which was usually somewhere in the Mid-South, headed down to Alabama, where, you know, I had a bunch of people surrounding me who were going to the same place as I was for Christmas, a bunch of fellow Alabamians. It's like you were only on the plane for like 5 minutes before everybody was talking to each other, making friends. Southern men are just so gregarious, you know, starting conversations, making you feel comfortable. And if I was on an airplane where something happened, I'd prefer to be with that group than the previous group. Again, where it's every man or every person for themselves.
And obviously, you know, there are manly men and feminine women in other parts of the country, but it does seem to be the rule rather than the exception here in the South. Folks, when we come back, we got a treat. Courtney's going to stay with us. We're going to wrap up the outline that she sent in. We got a couple of things we want to talk about with her before the time runs out, but we're going to play a full version of Dixie when we come back. All the verses, you're going
to
like it.
Back to the political cesspool right after these messages here on the Liberty News Radio Network.
Liberty is not free. Its costs are innumerable. Without monetary funding, the valiant efforts of freedom-loving Americans become diminished or outright defeated. We present a solution, the Give Me Liberty Fund. The plan is quite simple. Invite individual Americans to contribute less than a dollar a day. These monetary funds are used to promote liberty-minded media, organizations, events, candidates, movements, and speakers. In the spirit of transparency, all expenditures are published. Patriotic business owners provide discounted products and services to Give Me Liberty Fund members. Our greatest strength is in numbers. Go to GiveMeLibertyFund.com and become part of the solution today. GiveMeLibertyFund.com. Participate in the peaceful restoration of the greatest and freest country in the world.
When camping overnight, your tent is one of the most important items you'll have with you. That's why it's vital to have a quality tent that is easy to carry and will withstand the elements. Teton Sports offers top quality tents for any of your camping needs. The Outfitter XXL cot tent weighs only 4 pounds, but provides plenty of space for a comfortable night's sleep. Teton Sports also has a 6-man tent, which weighs only 14 pounds for camping overnight with friends and family. Each tent is easy to assemble and is easily transportable, and each is made with 1200mm coated polyester, providing strong and durable protection from weather and cold. Teton Sports also offers sleeping bags, backpacks, duffels, and more to ensure a quality outdoor experience. Wherever your outdoor adventures take you, you will be safe and comfortable in a quality tent from Teton Sports. Look for Teton Sports products at Amazon.com, Sportsman's Warehouse, Dick's Sporting Goods, Wholesale Sports, or visit TetonSports.com.
Yeah?
Did you want to see me, sir?
Well, I did, but now that I do, I'm not so sure.
Sir?
Johnson, I got a mission for you that could change your life.
Oh, good, sir.
It involves traveling halfway around the world without so much as half a clue of where you're going or what you're going to do when you get there.
Situation normal, sir?
Uh-huh. Right, I'll be leading this mission, Johnson, so I'll be telling you what to do.
You, sir?
That's right, Johnson, and I say first things first.
Oh, good plan, sir.
And what I say is first is food. Always remember that, Johnson. Food is a big deal.
Sir, my brother-in-law can get us a really good deal on some surplus MREs.
Johnson, if you've got half a brain and that empty head of yours, you'll call the freeze-dry guy like I did. That food is better for you, it rehydrates faster, and it's good, Johnson, and it keeps for up to 30 years.
Will we be gone that long, sir?
Well, I hope not. Now get your supplies organized and meet me down to the pier at dawn on Sunday. We sail at sunrise.
Yes, sir.
This adventure is brought to you by the freeze-dry guy. Call 866-404-3663 or visit freezedryguy.com.
Welcome back. To get on the show, call us on James's Dime at 1-866-986-6397.
All right. Alright, everybody, the full version of Dixie there. Interesting accent, and we're going to talk about accents this segment, but there's history in the music, history in that song, which is why we wanted to showcase it in its near entirety there. Certainly a topic of conversation in and of itself. Wrapping up things here with our guest, Courtney from Alabama, who's been talking about Southern culture, traditional gender roles as they exist in the South. Courtney, I'd like to ask you to wrap up as succinctly as you can and as efficiently as you can, because I know it's a couple of important topics. I want to be sure we cover both of them at least a little bit. I think, you know, obviously why we need to preserve our unique heritage is a no-brainer, but what makes the South unique in regards to our ancestry? What were some of the things you had in mind to share with us along those lines?
Okay, I'm going to go through this really quickly. I can't believe how quickly this went by, but okay. Yeah, when I lived in the Blue State, it's almost like I was this oddity within the office that I worked in. Everybody else loved Obama, males, females. They were both equally crazy for Obama. It was absolutely ridiculous. I was the only conservative. I was kind of picked on in a way for being, you know, the Southern Belle from Alabama. And somebody made a comment one time. Of course, I took it all in pride, but somebody made a comment one time about a Christmas party coming up, and they said, oh, we have somebody from Alabama in the office, and she's probably not going to wear shoes to the party. Well, you know, that's such an old joke, but, you know, it's like, not only did I show up in shoes, but I was also the most nicely dressed out of all the women. And also, you know, it's like, you know, I had women, you know, who were so impressed that I was able to stand and walk in heels for so long at the Christmas party. So anyways, it's like, it's just this entirely different culture up there, and I could go into so many other things, but I'm going to wrap it up. It's almost like, you know, Blue State liberals have this fascination with white Southerners, and that, you know, but they don't want to admit to, and it's like they see us as this exotic oddity, and they want to attribute all these bad characteristics to us that, you know, obviously blacks and Mexicans have, but instead of doting on us like they do Mexicans and blacks, It's almost like they hold us to a higher standard, you know, like we're not allowed to get pampered. We have to suck up to all the criticisms we get. And, you know, one thing that makes us really unique, and I know it's controversial to talk about in the movement, but it's true, and I think it kind of needs to be said, we need to remember that in the South, we're largely descended from the founding stock, and right. A lot of people in Blue State America are not. They're descended from immigrants that came over much later. from different parts of Europe. And, you know, I think we need to talk about that. I personally take offense knowing that, you know, my ancestors came over and created this country, and then we have people who came over later telling us what to do now. And, mm-hmm. you know, one of the funniest lines that I hear from somebody from Blue State America is, oh, you know, we really beat you guys during the Civil War. That's the most polite way I can say it. They usually say something else. But, you know, and what I say back is, well, number one, it wasn't we because your ancestors weren't even here yet. Number two, you really did not beat us. That, you know, it really was not that lopsided. And anyways, I find that funny. And so, you know, the fact that we are descended from the founding stock makes us unique. We're very homogenous. We're an old culture down here. And, you know, even our accents, you know, it's like I heard somebody mention one time, well, you know, why does Australia was founded by British people just like the United States was. Why have they kind of retained their British accent that America hasn't? Well, you know, and another person said, well, it's because we're the melting pot. Well, my response to that is there are parts of America where we have kind of retained the British accent, and that's in the South, and that's where the accent comes from. And, we're descended from the founding stock. I think we should be proud of that. And it's just another reason, even though it's divisive within the movement, it's another reason why I get so frustrated having these people, you know, tell me how I'm supposed to live down here when my ancestors were here 300 years before theirs were. And so that's my main point. So I guess to quickly go through the second part of my outline, that basically wraps it up.
Courtney, let me tell you something, sweetheart. You can talk. And I enjoyed this. And Keith and I, you can fill a radio show. I mean, that is impressive. This is what, your second interview? I mean, you're handling it like an old pro. I guess it's easy to talk when you're covering a topic that you're very passionate about. And it's great to see the passion in your voice as you discuss these things as they apply to our family. And I'm sure I'm speaking on behalf of the entire audience when I say you did a bang up job tonight.
And your accent is music to my ears, I can tell you that.
Well, you have an accent too. It's just a different kind. But thank you. Thank you very much. I'm very honored that y'all let me come on the show and talk about what I consider kind of fluff issues compared to, you know, talking about the generals of the Civil War who do need to be honored. And I guess what I'm talking about is a product of all that.
Well, it was interesting when you contacted us, I guess, earlier in the week and you know, made your pitch for something, you know, what you wanted to talk about. I thought it would tie in well, you know, because certainly you're thinking, well, Confederate History Month, you know, what is what we talked about tonight? And I guess I addressed this in passing earlier. You know, what does it have to do with the actual history of that period in American history? Keith, you can answer that, but it certainly, this is an extension of that. It still lives today, and so we celebrate that. Why just celebrate, you know, a four-year period that has come and gone? You know, this is something that still lives and breathes today.
Yeah, this is the legacy of the Civil War. The reasons for the Civil War were not slavery. Slavery was not a large part at all at what motivated the South to secede from the Union. What motivated it was that we're different people from a different culture, and we were being commissared by a group of people that were different from us and basically didn't like us. That's why our ancestors seceded. Pure and simple, we're also being economically exploited by them. And the fact that these differences, these cultural differences, persist to this day, despite the best efforts of the media in the blue states to pound us into submission and homogenization with the rest of blue state America, just shows you that these differences are very real and they're not going away.
Exactly. And God bless the parts of the South like Alabama and Mississippi that are still untouched by the blue state invasion, and hopefully it'll stay that way. I wish I could say there were other areas, but it seems like, I don't know, it seems like other states are starting to, like you mentioned Atlanta, and that's in Georgia, and Tennessee has its areas, and, of course, Texas and Florida, and then everything above, you know, north of there. So hopefully we can hold our own and maybe push back the tide at some point. And
well, as long as we have, you know, you mentioned your father earlier, and I, without, at the risk of sounding pretentious, I wanted to say God bless your dad, because I know you're a little younger than me, late 20s, early 30s, and if you don't mind me divulging that, I guess that's perhaps why.
That's okay.
But no, I mean, what I wanted to make that point, because you are a young woman, but still very right thinking. And so it just goes to show, folks, that, you know, don't believe the lie that the media tells you, that the respect that is shown towards the Confederacy and for the people who, as I say again, fought to preserve the American way of life. And Courtney rightly pointed out that these were the descendants of the people who fought in the Revolutionary War, the founding stock, much more so than what had developed in the North by that period in American history. But Courtney, listen, had a great time tonight. I'm glad you're able to stay a little bit longer than was originally appointed. And Confederate history will continue next week. Back to more contemporary news, I guess you could call it, here in the third
hour.
Stay tuned.
Of the political cesspool is in the can, but don't go away. There's more to come right here on the Liberty News Radio Network.